Okay. Hi, everyone. So glad you're being here. We're going to start from the very beginning, a very good place to start, as Julie Andrews once said in The Sound of Music. In this, what we're going to be doing today is we're going to sort of do a comparison of the creation stories, and we're going to explain the significance of it. We did this a little bit before, but we're going to do this a little more in detail. I shared that, of course, now I don't know where the book is. The book that I've been recommending, I think Elliot said he bought it, which was called Understanding Genesis by Nahum Sarna. Did you end up
I
getting
finished it.
it? You finished it. Okay, wow, that's very impressive. I haven't finished it. I just went through pieces.
I finished it, but I have like, and I don't want to detract from, I have some major problems with how he wrote it.
That's okay. Maybe we'll get a chance to tackle it. I'm not going to talk too much about Professor Sarna and his book, just to understand. Professor Sarna and Nahum Sarna of blessed memory, he wrote a book called Understanding Genesis. He also wrote a book called Exploring Exodus, which I own, which I just kind of cracked open, but I haven't really tackled. And what Professor Sarna does is he basically takes the different stories that we have, that we found from the different religions and cultures, and compares them to the biblical story. And doesn't mean that Professor Sarna actually was an observant Jew. Was a believer, but he actually and as he what he extrapolates, which I found and I most appreciate, is he extrapolates lessons from the way the creation story was written in the Torah, or the flood story is written in the Torah, or any many of the things that are written in the Torah, and he takes the lessons and what the intention or what Judaism's intention is, rather than the other religious cultures. And so this is what we're going to be doing today in a very superficial way. So we're not really going to dive into too much of Professor Sarna, except for one small piece. And the goal is to say, okay, now that it was written this way, what is the purpose of it? What are we trying to extract from that? So I'm going to give an example. Okay, so we're going to start, as we said from the beginning, we're going to start with Bereshit. Hold on, let me share my screen. At any point, since we have our top four students are here. Anybody can just jump in and feel free to ask your questions. Now, I have here, if you can see my screen, Bereshit Genesis chapter 1, yes? Okay, great. So I have here not just the verses of the first two verses, but I also have Rashi. And there's a reason why I want to study Rashi, because Rashi, of course, lives in the 11th century. He is the biblical commentary par excellence, and his commentary or his on certain things and how he approaches it is going to be extremely telling to us, and is written, again, keep in mind, 1,000 years ago. So it's going to have a whole different perspective for us. And let's start. So it says, of course, Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, right? That is the translation, correct? Any problems with that? Great. Well, of course there are problems with that, because that's not
Grammar.
right?
The word bereshit is kind of a compound word, I think, right? It's not the usual form of the word that you would expect.
It should say bahatchala, it should be
Yeah.
barishona. It should say in at first, right? So the fact that it's in the beginning, right? It already brings up some questions, and we're going to bring that up in a second. It also, just to in the interest of time, it tells us in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. And immediately we're going to see Rashi's question, which is, wait a second. What does it mean that God created in the beginning heaven and earth? Heaven and earth didn't exist yet. How do I even know that? Well, because if you go down a little bit, down a few verses, it says, verse 6, and God said, let there be an expanse. Verse 6 over here, God said, let there and there should be a separation between water and water. In other words, there was the rakia, which is the, they translate it as the expanse. I don't even know what expanse means. The firmament, which is the heaven, right? That there was water all the way up to heaven. Verse 7, Vayasa and the God made the expanse, this firmament, and he separated between the firmament of the water that was above the expanses and below. Basically, there was the world was filled with water of some form, right? And then God separated, which created an earth, right? Right? And he called the firmament, which is that splits, he called heaven. He called the sky. And so here we have the creation of the sky, heaven or Shamayim Ba'aretz. Here we have, so that happens on day two, which means that it didn't happen yet on day one, which means, and Rashi's going to see in a second, says that this was written out of order.
You could also say the same about the water. The water was created on day three.
Exactly. So if you look at the verse on verse two, Ba'aretz Haita, thank you, Elliot, Haita Tohu Bavo, the earth was astonishingly empty, which is a very strange Tohu Bavo, which basically means chaos. The choshech al pnei atom, and the darkness was on the face of the deep. Ruach Elokim merachefet al pnei amayim, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the water. I don't know what the Spirit of God means. I don't know what where the water is, because the water hasn't really been created yet. And so we have legitimate questions in the opening two verses of the creation story. And this is why it's important. Immediately, the first thing that Rashi says in the first Rashi, and actually I'll skip the first Rashi. I'm going to go to the second Rashi and just the beginning. It says, "In the beginning, God's creation of all." Right? It says this the verse, and this is how Rashi wrote: "Ein hamikra zeh omer ela darshani." The verse calls for a midrashic interpretation. In other words. This the words are screaming out to be interpreted into being having a drash, having some sort of how do we translate drash? Having some sort of exposition of some form that doesn't go for the literal meaning. Why? Because Rashi says it should be different. As it teaches us the sequence of creation, as written, is impossible. As it is written below, as the rabbi stated, and they have this whole thing, that he comes up with these different interpretations. But basically, just as we've described, the order of that it's described is impossible. It doesn't make any sense of what it's saying. It says, moreover, if you look at the last two lines here, the heavens were created from fire and water. Perforce, you must admit that the scripture did not teach us anything about the sequence of the earlier and the later acts of creation. The Torah, says Rashi, is not here to tell us the order of creation. That's what it's saying. Now, that's a pretty powerful thing.
It's not a history book.
Because it's not a history book. It's more than just not a history book. It's an incorrect history book. Because, and Ari's been in my class many times, and I always say the Torah is not a history book, but it's an incorrect history book. Because there's no way, we know even, first of all, Rashi's saying that it's an incorrect history book, and we know, based on all the science that we've had, that this is not really how they're describing how it happened. And when I was a kid, so they would say, I remember learning about how, that the world was 600 billion years old. And they would say, my teachers would say, the world can't be 600 billion years old because the world is only 5,781 years old now. And so obviously, people misunderstand, the scientists don't know. Here we have those question of dinosaurs. So, you know, there are dinosaurs don't exist. And so all of the things that people are saying that they found isn't true, it's not science, it's not valid, and we know the truth. That was what I learned. Now I'm in my mid-40s, right? So this is what I learned 40 years ago. And I would say over time, things evolved. Things evolved with a very different approach. And the approach would be, wait a second. There's a whole theory by Stephen Hawking, which talks about the Big Bang Theory. You can watch the movie, by the way. It was very interesting and well done. Anyone watch the movie? Anybody see that? Yeah.
It's a TV show, too.
It was a TV show. Oh, no, but that different thing. There was a movie about Stephen Hawking's life, which was very interesting. Less about his discoveries and more about his life.
But the Theory of Everything.
Theory of Everything. That was called. It was a very nice movie.
Excellent.
Yes. And so... But Stephen Hawking came out with this idea of the Big Bang Theory, right? Which is that basically things exploded, right? That the earth exploded with the meteor of some form, etc. And then everything sort of, creation sort of fell into place. I am oversimplifying the Big Bang Theory because my physics, PhD in physics, hasn't come yet, right? So I'm not going to go through and try to even attempt to understand that Big Bang Theory. But that's basically the idea that things kind of happen in an explosion of some form, and that's when our life started. It's not crazy. Originally, they taught us and said, that's terrible. That goes against everything we believe in, right? You had Galileo and Copernicus from hundreds of years earlier who were also thrown into exile by the church because the creationists believed that you have to follow the story exactly. And now you're coming along and you say, you know what? No. The Big Bang Theory is actually fits in pretty well because you could say that the earth was created, and then in fact, I believe it's the Ramban who says that God, that everything, the Ramban even takes this in sequence order. Everything was created, and then God put them in different places for the 7 days, right? And so it falls into place that there was some sort of explosion of some form that created this idea of the world, of the universe, and that doesn't go against the Jewish story of creation, the biblical story of creation. In addition, we have other stories, right? So if I tell you the world is 600 billion years old, so, but my Torah says, the Bible says that the world was 6 days old. So what's your response? One response is the scientists don't know anything.
The length of the year.
What?
We don't know the length of the year.
We don't know the length of a day, right?
Or a day.
Day could be billions and billions of years. And how do I even know that? Because I'll tell you, because it tells us, hold on a second, when in order to have a day as a 24-hour period, what do you need?
A sun.
You need a sun and you need a moon, right? Or you need a sun at least, right? And when was the sun created? It was on the fourth day. So it's very feasible to say that the first 4 days, when we say the world was created in 4 days, I mean a 24-hour period, there was no such thing as a 24-hour period. It's very feasible to say that it took place over billions and billions of years. In addition, my friend's the dinosaur. I just watched my kids who look for a family movie. So it's today's movie suggestion day, right? So we watched Night at the Museum. Have anybody watched that with their kids and grandkids?
It's an excellent movie.
Excellent movie. There you go. And so Night at the Museum has the dinosaur in the middle of the Museum of Natural History. And I was told that dinosaurs don't exist. And then, of course, if I look at day 5, it tells us in verse 21, Vayivra Elokim et Hataninim Hagadolim, which are translated as the great sea monsters. Right? So what's that, Moby Dick? I have no idea, right? And tells us there were these great sea monsters that were created. And this is not a midrash, this is a text. What day is this created?
This is fifth day.
5. What else is created on day 5? Birds and reptiles, right? Now, ironically, this word tanin is seen one other place, and that actually is when Moshe throws down his stick. We're told that it turns into a snake, but it doesn't turn into a snake. It actually turns into a tanin, which is assumed to be the translation of some sort of reptile. And so here you have, if you had described a gigantic reptile bird-type creature, what would you call that? That's dinosaurs, right? And that was created on day five. And so, and so then if there was a theory that comes along that says that at some point, billions of years ago, there was some sort of meteor that came and hit the earth that was about 12 miles long, and the heat of the earth, the temperature of the earth to astronomical high levels, and therefore all the many living things, most of the living things died, including that the dinosaurs. So I can find all of this explanation within the text, within the framework of the text, and there is no contradiction to the biblical creation story than to the story that we have, than what science is telling me. And if you read Genesis and the Big Bang by Dr. Gerald Schroeder, he has a mathematical equation to basically describe how the world is somewhere around 600 billion years old within the framework of the text of the Torah, of the Bible, and the various commentaries of the Talmud. All that is fantastic. Here's the thing. This is the big curveball. I don't care because it doesn't bother me anymore. Because as Rashi was telling me, if I want to be able to find that the creation story takes place in order, exactly how it's described, or you know, within the framework of described, find answers to be able to resolve that with the science that we know today. Keep in mind that we know how much we know today versus what they knew 150 years ago, right? And with the science that we know today versus, and I can come up with ways to figure all this out. But I think Rashi's telling us something very important, and he's not the only one. It doesn't matter. Because the way the Torah is describing the creation story is not necessarily meant to be taken literally. Now, Arnie said it before, one of my favorite lines, which is that the Torah is
not a history book.
Because when we read history, we assume that I'm going to take a history book and I'm going to say, well, in 1812, there was the War of 1812, which was a great name for a war. If you're going to have a war, right? And you're going to have, and it has all the description of who fought in the war, how the war, et cetera, et cetera. And it goes through where all the facts that took place. And that is what we, that is the modern definition of the word history. What's we're finding out pretty clearly is that that is a modern definition. The ancient definition of history was not that at all. The ancient definition of history was completely different. It wasn't meant to be a list of facts. It was meant to tell a story with an agenda. The agenda was usually dependent on who was writing the history book. The historian was not a fact finder. They would take information and they would distort it or use it for their own agenda. Now, you might say that's terrible, right? It's not terrible because the reader expected it. The reader, the listener, they all expected it. That was part. That was just normal what everybody does. These aren't going to say, you know, you're not going to be, there's no fact finders, right? There's no one going to come in and after the debate between the presidential candidates and say, oh, this was made up and the fact finders or whatever. Nobody cared about the fact finding because that was not the agenda. The agenda was whatever the speaker, the historian wanted to put out, that was the agenda.
And it was like Josephus, I guess, also had his agenda.
Josephus had an agenda as well when he worked for the Roman government, right? So he had a very strict agenda. And one of the primary objectives, and this is, so Josephus is much later, remember. We're now in Rome at the turn of the millennium, right? In the beginning of the Common Era. Josephus is much later. Go back 1,000, 1,500 years ago, and you're just so far behind. It's even more, quote unquote, prehistoric. So any of the fragments of history that we find, and we're going to see one piece right now, is, or I should say, anything we'll find, particularly what would interest us, are things that will be found as contemporaries of the Bible, right? So if we believe the Bible is 3,300 years old, so what's being written at that time? What is out there at the time? What language is being used at the time? That is significantly relevant because it's the same way it's telling a history story. It doesn't necessarily mean that's exactly what happened. It doesn't even, and I gave a class not too long ago about Moshe himself in the beginning of Sefer Devarim. I don't know, Arnie, if you remember, beginning of Sefer Devarim, Moshe distorts facts that the people saw, you know, a few weeks earlier, right? And he just distorts it, and they don't have a problem. They go, hey, Moshe, aren't you making that up? No, he has no problem making it because that's how historians work. And so the Torah is going to be working the same way.
Where does the 5781 then come from? Who established that?
So we believe in some form that man was created or Adam was created somewhere in that year 5781 around there. That as far as our history works, you know, the academics are looking somewhere between the first and the second temple period, or the second and the third temple period, somewhere in the first second temple period. Is about 130 years it's missing. So that we don't know. So it's very nice to add up to 5781. It just doesn't, somewhere it's missing. So it could be a lot of things are a little off, or maybe certain dates that we have are off. the way they used to date things. We have things in the Tanakh that says that things happen over that, you know, Shlomo ruled for 40 years. You know, even that is you know, a misnomer. He could have taken over at a certain date, and that counts as, at the end of a year, and that counts as a year. And then he could have ended at a certain date, and that counts as a year, and it would only have been 38 and a half years. I'm just giving an example. That's just how they enumerated years, and they counted it for the laws of kings. So there are years missing. There are years missing. But that's so we believe that 5,781 years ago, Adam was created in some form on that day.
That's and they counted from that day a normal year?
That's what we believe. So when Adam lived 930 years, you can imagine how much Social Security he collected. if you think they had trouble collecting
it. Yeah, but it was covered by Medicare, so.
Right, sorry. Yeah, Medicare, had health insurance, the whole thing. It was this much smaller population, right? So it's like, you know, this is the fear people actually have. This is the crazy fear of the world now. People are afraid of living too long because they'll run out of money. Used to be people were afraid of living too short. Now they're afraid of living too long. It's just another way the world is upside down in 2020. Okay, so with that introduction, what I want to do, first I want to make sure that everybody's clear on this. I want to do is I want to be able to take this story, compare it to another similar creation story, and get it under and try to extract what then, if that's the case, then what is the Torah trying to teach us? What is the biblical account of creation trying to teach us if this is their version of the story? But I want to take one step back first. You know, I heard one of the people I like to study is Dr. Joshua Berman. Dr. Joshua Berman is a professor at Bar-Ilan University, and they very into this line of thinking. Also, an ordained Orthodox rabbi from lives in Israel, but very much takes Middle Eastern culture from the time of the Torah was written, and compares them to different Far East religions, etc. And he told the story, and I'm forgetting it might not have been him even. He tells the story that he said that there was a guy who told him he was in the hospital. In Shari Tzedek Hospital, and he witnessed a chassid and a secular Israeli professor, and the secular Israeli, so they're in the hospital together, right? And they share a room, and so now you just start talking. So the professor says, right, an archaeologist, I think it was, and says, you know, I don't understand. I have all this evidence that there is another flood story. Every culture has a flood story, and every culture has a creation story. And if that's the case, how do you believe in the Torah? And the chassid said, Baruch Hashem, because now you're just affirmed to me that the Torah is true. If every story, every culture, every religion has a flood story, so now the Torah has a flood story. Now I know, before I could doubt it, now I know it's true, right? If every story has a creation story, every religion, every culture has a creation story. So the Torah has a creation story. Now I know that it's true because it affirms the fact that it existed. The only question is how is it told? Because how it's told is there to tell us what its agenda, what the author's agenda is. In our case, we believe the author is God. Are you with me? Yes? Any questions on this? Because this is pretty important before we start jumping. Okay, good. So what I'm going to do is I want to share a document. I'm back. I want to share a document that we have that I was working on based on a few articles. One of them came out just today. It was actually a beautiful article by Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, who, of course, I can't find it. Hold on a second. Oh, you know what? I put it on a Google Doc. That's why. Okay, so it should be here. Can you see my document? Yes, it says the first tab of Enuma Elish begins with the following statement. Yes? Okay, so this is actually an article by Rabbi Ephraim Buchwald. from National Jewish Outreach Program. I found it. He wrote an article about 10 years ago based on Rabbi Professor Sarna's book. And he explained in the background, he explained that they found seven tablets, which I believe now is in the British Museum, that has a description of the creation story in ancient Mesopotamia. And it's one of the earliest things that we found that we're able to date. And this is how it starts. The tablet is called Enuma Elish. Enuma Elish, this is the first of the seven tablets. It says, when the sky above was not named, and the earth beneath did not yet bear a name, and the primeval Apsu who begat them, and Chaos Tiamat, the mother of them both, their waters were mingled together, and no field was formed, no marsh was to be seen, when the gods, none had been called into being. When of the gods, none had been called into being. And then he explains. Babylonian creation epic states that before the formation of heaven and earth, nothing existed except water, which, based on our story, it sounds very familiar. However, when these waters, represented by Apsu, who was the primeval god of sweet water, and Tiamat, the god of salt water, were commingled, they spawned the fine offspring. So these two gods, the god of salt water and the god of fresh water, of sweet water, came together and they had an offspring. And their offsprings were gods too. These newly created gods caused great turmoil. The older gods tried to destroy them, but were thwarted by the all-wise earth-water god, Ea. Ultimately, another god, Marduk, which we should be familiar with. Marduk was the primary god of the Babylonians at the time. Incidentally, there's the biblical name that's very similar to Marduk. What's that? Mordechai. Mordechai, for sure, is a Persian name. It was not probably his given name. Marduk. In addition, by the way, he had a counterpart who also, what was Mordechai's counterpart's name? They named the book after her.
Esther.
Esther. What does Esther sound like?
Apsu.
Not Apsu, but not a god here, but another god. In fact, they made a Dustin Hoffman movie out of it. Speaking of movies, it was terrible from what I understand. That is Ishtar. Ishtar was the Persian god. They were all foreign gods. They were given these names. It was pretty clear these weren't their names. But Marduk, that's where Marduk. Marduk was the primary god of the Babylonians, Persians at that time. It says, and Marduk is selected to address the threat. Another god, Marduk, is selected to address the threat. Marduk kills Tiamat and forms the earth from her corpse. Babylon is then established as a residence of the chief god, and Marduk becomes the king over all the gods. That is their creation story. That's their creation story. And that is the oldest creation story that we have. And what's there are similarities, and then there are very different, tremendous differences. What I want to do for the next few minutes is I want to take out lessons that I found and I shared that Rabbi Greenberg just shared an article about this morning. So it was actually much easier for me. I was planning on teaching this anyway, and God handed me that. And so and I want to go through some of the things that we learn from our creation story versus their creation story. Okay? Remember, if that's the way history is written, history, their version of history. Why is the story told this way? Their story is told that way for one reason. I want to know what our story is told our way. Well, the first thing is that we have our story has the creation was intention, right? In their story, basically because of some sort of war between the gods, right? So then Marduk kills Tiamat and forms the earth from her corpse, et cetera, right? So this is random. This is random. Here we have God's intention. God wanted to create the world. And if they have God's intention, it means that this world is not an outcome of a blind and random physical process that has no values or goals and end in oblivion, right? Rather, it has an intended outcome. As he quotes from Isaiah, it was not created to be void. It was brought into being to be filled with life. The first thing we learn is that there was that God came and Vayara, and it says he or with even those words, and there should let there be light. That means there was intention. Everything was, tells us about Asara Mamamarot, in the 10 sayings God created the world. He was very clear, according to this version, on how the world wanted, he wanted the world to be created, how he wanted it to be laid out in this version of the story. Therefore, there was intention for this world. This world is not a random accident. We are here and placed here for a reason with intention. It's a huge thing if you think about it, right? Otherwise, people, if you don't believe that, then you believe that we're all just accidents, right? And everything that happened here is just an accident with no intention whatsoever. And it leads to a world that is purposeless. Correct?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
On that. Okay, let's go to lesson number two then. Number two, it's God's involvement in the world, right? And what was very common in the cultures, and I'll just compare some of this here, the other gods don't really care about what happens in this world, right? The other god, Marduk, formed the world.
The world.
Out of the whatever the remains of the corpse of Tiamat, right? And everybody else doesn't care, and there are a whole bunch of other gods who don't care about it. And in fact, this was a very common thing, is that the religions believe that you're supposed to do whatever you can to pacify the gods so they won't be angry at you, right? And so you had all these, you had the god of water, and you had the god of fire, and you had a, and they would bring sacrifices. Now, remember, we described what sacrifices are. Where does this idea of sacrifices come from? Well, when you would burn an animal, right? So even we have in our text, a reach nachoach la'Hashem, a pleasant smell to God. What does that mean, a pleasant smell to God? The answer is that what happens when you burn something is that smoke comes out, right? And where does the smoke go? It goes up. And so that they believe that they were sending the smelling, the beautiful smell to the other gods, or blood, as they would often sacrifice their children, as was a common behavior, because they needed to do something to pacify the gods. This was something that was, because the gods here, they don't care about what goes on over here in this world, the gods up there. And we just have to make sure that we're nice to them so they won't try to destroy us.
I think Rabbi Sarna makes that connection by Akedat Yitzchak to say that this differentiates us from these other texts, that we're totally against the idea of offering children to God.
Right. And in fact, that was one of the challenges. Thank you, Eliab. One of the challenges of Avraham during the Akedah is, imagine these are things that he's been preaching for all of these years. And now it comes along, God says something that goes as antithetical to what he's been teaching. That his understanding of God is that God doesn't want us to do human sacrifices. God has no interest in human sacrifices. That's God doesn't want us to die for him. He wants us to live for him. And so this would come out of this, because God is involved in the world. Creation means that there's a shaping creator, an infinite consciousness that knows every one of the endless numbers of stars and loves every one of God's creations. The idea that the gods cared about human beings was just so counter. The gods were up there and they had no interest in the humans, except when they would get angry, they would destroy them. And send some sort of plague, etc. And Judaism says, no. God specifically created every little single thing in order, and because he cared about each thing, including not just humans, but all things. The third thing we have is the unity, right? All of reality is unified and governed by a universal natural process, which means that there's one God. Their belief is that the gods are fighting, right? And so you could choose God, right? You have to choose which God you want to pacify, and that God is the arch nemesis of the other gods. That's polytheism. Polytheism in general becomes this idea that you're believing in the many gods and you're trying to pacify all of them, and sometimes they don't like each other, etc. Here we have this idea that there's one Bereshit Bara Elohim. One God created the earth, not many gods, not in a fight, not that you have to try to pass by them, but there is one source, and therefore there's one universal idea of morality versus the many things that you need to do to pacify all the different gods. Number four is God is the ultimate artist, right? The precision that he creates the world. Even, you know, the way we have before is in the other version, you have God's Murdoch taking the form of the corpse and sort of forming, you know, and making a big mush, and there's Earth. Or even you have the Big Bang Theory, which is that everything explodes, etc. In our version of the story that we're getting, it tells us that God is the ultimate artist. And therefore, it is imperative upon us to appreciate his art. It's an amazing thing, right? There's a great story that's been attributed to different rabbis. I've heard it in the name of Rav Shimshon Ufel Hirsch. I've heard it in others. I don't really know where the story is. And if it's apocryphal, it's still a good story. The story is about this man was sitting on the train, and they said to Rav Hirsch, who was the chief rabbi of Germany at the time in the 19th century, he said, he's sitting in the back of the train. And he says, excuse me, Rav Hirsch, excuse me, oh, where are you going? Then Rav Hirsch says, I'm going to see the Swiss Alps. And so the man says, listen, I don't mean to be presumptuous, and excuse me for being rude, which is not the Jewish way. But he asks, he says, if that's the Canadian way, but not the Jewish way, right? So he asks,
yeah,
you know, with all due respect, and everybody knows when you say with all due respect, Rabbi, then you can say whatever you want afterwards, right? With all due respect, Rabbi, you're an idiot, right? So with all due respect, Rabbi Hirsch, I don't understand. Don't you have something better to do than to travel halfway, you know, all these thousands of miles, just hundreds of miles, just to see the Swiss Alps? And Rav Hirsch said, according to the legend, he said, listen, when I come up to God and he asks me, did I study this or did I do this or did I help this person? I'll have what to answer. I hope I'll have to answer. But when I come up to heaven and God says, so what do you think of my Alps, right? So I need to be able to answer the question. And therefore, it felt the impetus to appreciate the creations of God. If everything is a creation, then if everything is created by God specifically and designed, then that God is the ultimate artist, and we are supposed to appreciate God's incredible art. Abraham Joshua Heschel had a phrase called radical amazement. He said everything is wondrous. If you really look at God's creations, everything's phenomenal. Everything's wondrous. We'd be blown away. We wouldn't be able to stop for a moment without appreciating the incredible creations that God had. And by the way, Maimonides, the Rambam, in Hilchot Yisodei HaTorah, the foundation of the Torah, in chapter 2, that is how you come to love and have awe of God, is by learning about his creations and learning in depth science, biology, you know, physics, etc. And you'll ultimately come to be in awe and in love with God because of his incredible artwork. That's number four. And I miscounted here. So, excuse me. Number five, partnership. God created man, B'Tselem Elokim, which incidentally is by far the most important contribution of the Bible, of the Torah, and Rabbi Sachs says that all the time. That is our gift to the world, that man is created in the image of God. I have to give a talk next week on a panel of a Christian and a Muslim and a me and a rabbi, right? And it's a joke. We all go to a bar, right? The topic is about civil rights. And my talk begins and ends very quickly because it starts with this idea that we believe in the man is created in the image of God, that everybody is created with inalienable rights and an image of God. That is, we take that for granted. And I've said this a lot over the time of the pandemic. The fact that the entire universe stopped, the entire earth stopped what they were doing because they were worried about saving human life. That's a 21st century idea. That is a progress. You know, years ago, when they would build, right, they would build a bridge, and if somebody would build us anything, a building, and if somebody died, they would just continue building over him, like it was irrelevant. And they find this all the time. Human lives were lost and taken all the time, and nobody cared. And here you have not just a Judeo-Christian value. The entire world shut down to help to protect people because human life was the most important thing, including the economy. It's the phenomenal thing. That is a biblical concept. That is the founding biblical concept of that we find in the first chapter of creation. And in addition, we have that God is partnering with God, with man, where he asks Avdo L'Shamro, man, place, God places man in the garden, Avdo L'Shamro, to guard it, to work it and guard it. And that man has a responsibility to partner with God in creation and in protection. And that is also that man is relevant and is empowered. And finally, we have, and there's plenty more, and if you have any thoughts also, I would love to hear. We have the idea that the world is progressing, right? The creation story has, basically, you start with light, then you have the separation of the waters, you have on the third day, that's day two, on the third day you have vegetation, you have on the fourth day you have luminaries, on the fifth day you have more life, birds and fish, etc. And on the sixth day you have human and animals and humans. And so there's a progression of human life, and that it builds and builds and builds and builds, and that the world becomes more more perfect, or as imperfect as the word, and where our job is to help making the world more perfect. We have to recognize that there's progress that's constantly being made, and even a positive progress. And keep in mind how the first verse of the creation story tells us what? Let's go back. I don't have it here. First verse of creation tells the world is tovu, it's chaotic, right? What's the last verse of the creation story tell us?
It's very good.
Very good, but actually that was a trick question, because that wasn't the last verse of the creation story. That was the last verse of the sixth day of creation. There was a seventh day of creation, and that was God created what? Which is perfection, where nothing is missing and everything is in its place. On Shabbos, we don't ask for things. We pray for health because people are there. It's a whole question whether or not we should make a mishaberach for cholim. The truth is that we don't pray for things on Shabbat, because Shabbat is perfect, because we don't need anything. And you went from the first part of creation where everything was chaotic and nothing made any sense, and then you go and you have Shabbat 7 days later, and everything's perfect and missing nothing. And so the world is actually not falling apart, but the lesson is that the world has a goal of perfection, and we progress towards that. These are just like, so I just highlighted five or six, I think it was six, thoughts. Some of them I found, as I said, Rabbi Greenberg kind of really did a beautiful job putting that together also, but some of them I saw over time, and I'm sure there are more. And I think this is the important significance. Like, you know, so I know, Elliot, you said you had a lot of problems with Dr. Sarner's book. We'll have to talk at a different time, right? But
it's how he wrote certain things, right? Like he'll refer to the Hebrew authors of the Bible as though people wrote it.
He's an academic. This is what he's supposed to do. That's how academics write.
But if he's an Orthodox Jew, like you're saying, he would never write that.
It could be. I don't know. I would ask him, but he died, so I can't really ask him. His work was groundbreaking, and I would say that if you want to have another approach, there's a book that came out recently called Ani Mamin by Professor Joshua Berman that has very similar ideas. Similar ideas, not as academic, very similar ideas, and also very similar to as a traditionalist, as someone who's an observant Orthodox believer. And keeping in mind that, and he talks about this, Professor Berman, he talks about a lot how his challenge is that he has to swim with all the academics. And the academics are, none of them are believers, right? They all believe that the Torah was written by various authors and human, et cetera, et cetera. The one exceptions group that he has is, well, the people who love him are the Christians. Christians love him, right? The Christian biblical scholars love him because he's a believer, as they are. But the academics, that's just a whole world of non-believers. Either way, I think that, and this was, to me, this was like life-changing, because like when you come in and you say, and as I said, this was an evolution for me, no pun intended, for to be able to see how, where I started and where we were taught as young kids on the creation story, and then to come to this round of revelation, I don't need to have to fit everything in. I don't need to be defensive. For me, Rashi is implying that that these words are here to give us this message, and the specifics of it are irrelevant other than the lessons that it's there to try to convey. And there are incredible amounts of lessons that form us and form who we are in the Jewish religion, because we believe in this version of the creation story.
But the Ramban does challenge him quite openly that it was written in order, at least.
Yes.
Whereas Rashi says no. I think Ibn Ezra also says it was written in order, and he says
right.
No.
No, I think the Ibn Ezra agrees with Rashi, if I'm not mistaken. But
right, that's what I'm saying. He's on Rashi's side.
Yeah, no, there are, you know, as I said, there are different approaches to this, but I think Rashi never read Professor Sarna, right? Rashi doesn't really have an understanding of ancient Middle Eastern culture and Far Eastern culture. He doesn't have an understanding of this. Already he's recognizing, I think, this idea that paves the way for us to be firm believers in the authenticity and the divinity of the Torah, even more so. To me, this actually supports that the Torah is divine, because it doesn't have to find ways to jump into hula hoops and explaining one of the more enigmatic and difficult stories, which is the creation story. Arnie, you had a comment?
Just a mathematical correction.
Okay, yes, sir.
Anyway, that should be VI, not IV.
Ah, thank you. Thank you. There you go. Now my work is complete. Okay, we got that on Facebook, so now you've been recorded. okay. Any before we wrap up, I this was a pretty heavy class. I hope, however, I think there was a lot in here. There was a lot in here. And luckily, this creation story comes every year, so we can get to tackle it in a different way. And my hope is that you look at these stories. Next week, we're going to try to do the same as Professor Sarna does, with the Noah story, with the flood story. And what is the intention of this version of the story? What is it trying to bring out? What lessons bring out? And that's really, especially the first 11 chapters of the Torah, that's imperative, I think, for us to truly get what I believe was the Torah's intention, according to my humble opinion. So I hope we thank you very much for joining us.
Rabbi, in the Torah itself, wasn't there a discrepancy about the sixth day? There were two different stories in the Torah. There were
two different stories of creation.
Right.
If we had more time, we would go through that, which is, if we had another time, because that's another awesome class. Specifically, that's the teaching of Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was the one who really enlightened that in his book, Lonely Man of Faith, where he describes that the two versions of creation. In chapter one, there's one version on the sixth day. And then the beginning, and then chapter two, there's another version of the creation story, and that why there are so why it's so different. The Rabbi Soloveitchik and the biblical academic scholars will say, well, there are two different authors, and Rabbi Soloveitchik is saying, no, there's one author who's explaining the complexities of man as they're created. Man is a conqueror versus man is a sensitive and a learner and fragile. Very, very different. If we had more time, we don't. But there's, so it's just an amazing thing. So and I would say that Rabbi Soloveitchik's analysis of this was also transformational. Probably the best you'll find, and been quoted several times by David Brooks in his articles in the New York Times. And actually, I think in one of his books, he based it on Rabbi Soloveitchik's article. So with that said,
now I have to read the second chapter, which will give a little more insight.
So read the first chapter of the sixth day on the sixth day, and then read the beginning of the second chapter, and you'll see the difference on how man is created. Man is created by, together with woman in chapter one. Man is created by himself in chapter two. Mm-hmm. Just, and again, there's a whole lot here. We could spend endless amounts of hours discussing the five chapters of Bereshit, wish we had more time. But we'll move on. In the meantime, we thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.